All right, am I good to go? Do we have any introductory stuff? Okay. All right, I have, like most speakers, I have a lot of material to get through, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. So my task today is to talk about seismic anisotropy and seismic attenuation and what they can tell us about how the Earth's interior works. So I'm going to set this up by casting everybody back to Sana's excellent intro seismology lecture on Monday, and she did a great job of taking us through some of the fundamentals, including the derivation of the wave equation, right? So when I teach my intro seismology class, this is actually my very favorite lecture to teach. I love how you can take two, like, really simple pieces of physics. You can take F equals ma, and you can take Hooke's law, and you get this elegant equation that tells us all these beautiful things about wave propagation. So I absolutely love this. But I do want to remind you that in the process of doing this derivation, we made several assumptions, right? So one is that we decided that we would ignore lateral heterogeneity, basically ignore the gradient terms of these elastic parameters, the Lemay parameters here, lambda and mu. We said we were going to assume an isotropic version of Hooke's constitutive relationship. So we decided to ignore anisotropy, and we decided to assume a perfectly elastic medium. Okay? And Sana was very upfront in saying, tipping you guys off, that none of those assumptions, of course, is strictly true. The theme of this meeting is lateral heterogeneity in the deep Earth. So we sort of know that that one's not strictly true. And the focus of my lecture today is going to be on how these assumptions of isotropy and perfectly elastic behavior, in fact, aren't right, and we can actually take advantage of that fact to learn some stuff we want to know about how the Earth's interior works. So just a little bit of a roadmap for today's lecture. I'm going to talk about both anisotropy and attenuation, and for both of these observables, I'm going to talk a bit about what it is, why we should care about it, how we measure it, what are some of the caveats and challenges with making and interpreting these measurements, and then I'm going to show some key results. So just a little bit of a, to be upfront about the focus of the talk and my own biases, I'm going to talk more about anisotropy than attenuation, and it's not necessarily because it's more important, it's just that this is a strong interest of mine. And the other thing is that I do want to warn you that particularly when we are talking about anisotropy, my own perspective is pretty body wave-centric, even though I will talk a little bit about surface waves and normal modes as well. Okay, so just to sort of begin at the beginning and just remind us all what we're talking about when we talk about seismic anisotropy. So this is the situation in which the speed at which a seismic wave propagates depends on its direction. Okay, so this could be a propagation direction. So here, this is just real simple. We have a seismic wave traveling faster. This velocity is faster than this velocity. Okay, and I've illustrated this with a photograph of a single crystal of olivine. Olivine is one of the primary constituents of the upper mantle. We've seen that already in several different lectures. It's an example of a mineral, of an Earth material that has very strong anisotropy. Shear waves travel roughly 18% slower in this direction than in this direction. So the Earth is made of constituent minerals, and in many cases, perhaps even most cases, those materials are themselves anisotropic. So again, casting back to the way we've framed seismic wave propagation so far, this is a slide from CIDR a few years ago, but Sana showed a very similar picture in her talk. We talked about how we have shear waves, and we have P waves, compressional waves, and we can describe these for the isotropic case with two elastic parameters, right? So either the Lemay parameters, lambda and mu, or here I've cast this in terms of the bulk modulus K and the shear modulus mu. So the situation, again, as Sana noted in her talk, gets a lot more complicated when you consider anisotropy. So now, instead of relating stress and strain here via Hooke's law, this is the elastic constitutive relationship, instead of relating them with two parameters, bulk modulus and shear modulus, or equivalently the Lemay parameters, now it takes this sort of nasty fourth-rank tensor. So we're relating this 3x3 stress tensor to this 3x3 strain tensor with a fourth-rank tensor that has 81 components in it. As Sana noted, there are symmetries in the elastic tensor that reduce this to 21 independent terms. So we have only 21 constants to worry about. And so the upshot of all of this is that the equations get tricky, and I'm going to spare you all of the delightful equations that describe wave propagation in anisotropic media. But the upshot of this is that the wave speed now varies with direction, And we now have three possible polarizations. So instead of P and S waves, we now have a quasi-P and two quasi-S waves. Now, 21 independent terms. So as Sana noted, you're never, ever, ever, as an observational seismologist, going to have enough data to actually constrain all 21 of those. The Earth helps us out in the sense that a lot of these minerals have symmetries. So think back to Kanani's lecture yesterday, where she took us through this sort of gallery of mineral symmetries. And a lot of those have, for particular crystal symmetries, they're going to have fewer than 21. So for an orthorhombic mineral, we need, for example, 9 independent elastic moduli. Okay, so where in the Earth do we have anisotropy? The answer is almost everywhere, not quite everywhere. This is a little bit of a complicated cartoon that is sort of meant to illustrate this. This is showing here, this line is a 1D model for radial anisotropy, and I'm going to tell you what that is in a minute and how it varies with depth in the Earth. So we have radial anisotropy most strongly here in the upper mantle, probably not much in much of the lower mantle. We have in many models, we probably have some at the base of the mantle, and then very strong anisotropy as well in the inner core. This is sort of more of a cartoon view of the same thing. We have very strong anisotropy in many parts of the crust. I'm going to talk about that not at all in this talk. In the upper mantle, we have anisotropy sort of beneath ocean basins, and it often varies in a fairly regular way, where you have strong SH greater than SV anisotropy beneath the center part of an ocean basin. We have anisotropy associated with subduction zones as you have slabs going down. We have anisotropy in the continental lithosphere that's often frozen in from past tectonic processes. And then as you go deeper, we have anisotropy in the transition zone, the mantle transition zone. Most of the lower mantle is generally thought to be isotropic. And then we have strong anisotropy again at the base of the mantle and the D double prime layer. So we have anisotropy in a lot of parts of the Earth, and that means that we have to worry about it and worry about how it expresses itself in wave propagation. But it also means that we have lots of exciting sort of places where we can study this and put some constraints on Earth processes. If you want a sort of general and not super long review paper on anisotropy, particularly in the mantle, I'll be shameless and recommend this one because I wrote it along with Torsten Becker, who's going to be here later in the CIDR program. This figure is from this paper in EPSL that came out actually at this point about 8 years ago. Okay, so that's a bit about where anisotropy is in the Earth. I want to define some terms that you're going to hear in this lecture and you will often see in the anisotropy literature. So we often make a distinction between what's known as radial anisotropy and what's known as azimuthal anisotropy. It's important to keep in mind that these are not actually different things, and you know, many regions of the Earth have both types. You know, they exhibit both radial anisotropy and both and azimuthal anisotropy. But what we mean here when we say radial anisotropy is that this is a difference in propagation speed between horizontally and vertically polarized waves. So for surface waves, which are propagating horizontally, we have Love waves that involve horizontal particle motion. They're SH polarized. We have Rayleigh waves that involve a combination of P and SV, vertically polarized motion. We often see a discrepancy between Love and Rayleigh wave propagation speeds that is due to anisotropy. And that geometry is called radial anisotropy. Azimuthal anisotropy refers to the directional dependence of wave speed with azimuth in the horizontal plane. So this is often what we're getting at when we look at shear wave splitting of nearly vertically vertically propagating seismic phases. The term transverse isotropy, this describes a particular symmetry of anisotropy. It's equivalent to hexagonal anisotropy. So instead of those 21 elastic constants in the elastic tensor, we simplify it to 5 independent parameters. It's called transverse isotropy because in this geometry, you basically have one velocity in one direction, and then in the plane orthogonal to that, all the velocities are the same. And you can have this in a vertical configuration where your symmetry axis is vertical. That's known as VTI. Horizontal is known as HTI. And then sometimes you'll see references to tilted TTI. And again, you know, this, particularly this guy, a tilted transverse isotropy geometry will have, in general, both radial and azimuthal anisotropy. And then the final term that I just want to define is polarization anisotropy. You'll often run across this term in the anisotropy literature. This term is actually sometimes used a little bit differently by different people, but in general, it refers to anisotropy that manifests itself basically in the polarization behavior of seismic waves. So shear wave splitting would be an example of this. All right, so why do we have anisotropy in the mantle? Yes, Laurent, I can repeat, or we have a mic over here. There it is.
Oh, okay.
Great.
Sorry. You know, the mic is turning around me just like the waves and the polarization.
Yes.
So I was actually, a point of clarification.
Yes.
When you talk about the anisotropy here, you're talking about the polarization of the wave, that is the motion of the particle. You're not talking about the propagation of the wave. So if I'm comparing, for example, a horizontally moving and a vertically moving wave,
right.
Is that related to one of those four terms?
Yeah, sort of. So the answer is yes. So as Laurent noted, the direction in which you're, so let's think of a shear wave, right? So you have a wave that's propagating in some arbitrary direction. So its particle motion, the two quasi-shear waves, are going to be polarized more or less orthogonal, in the plane orthogonal to the propagation direction. But depending on whether you have, say, a vertically propagating wave like an SKS phase, I'll get to that in a second, in that case, both of your quasi-S waves are polarized in the horizontal plane, and that's going to be sensitive to azimuthal anisotropy. For the case where you have a horizontally propagating wave, like a surface wave, you know, your Rayleigh wave is going to be vertically polarized, your Love wave is going to be horizontally polarized, and in that case, you're going to be sensitive to radial anisotropy. So it absolutely, what sort of aspect of the anisotropic geometry you're sensitive to absolutely depends on the geometry of your ray path and the configuration of the different polarizations of your shear wave. Which is why some of these terms get a little tricky, because they are sort of describing a combination of the physical properties of the Earth as well as the properties of the waves that you're using to study them. Does that make sense? Okay. So I've told you already that the Earth is made of constituent minerals, many of which have an intrinsic anisotropy, and olivine is the prime suspect here in the upper mantle. But in thinking about why sort of large portions of the Earth have a bulk or sort of apparent anisotropy, there's actually a little bit more to the story. Okay? And the idea here is that if you have a rock, a collection of individual crystals, a mineral such as olivine, if you take that rock and say you start out with a rock that has randomly oriented olivine crystals, you know, these are crystals, you know, on a micro scale, certainly much smaller than the wavelength of a seismic wave, if all of those crystals are randomly oriented, then on the scale of a seismic wave, those orientations, that anisotropy is basically going to average itself out, okay? But if you take that same rock, oops, if you take that same rock, okay, and shear it, apply deformation, and if that deformation is accommodated in the dislocation creep regime, where you're accommodating that change in shape of the material by moving around dislocations within the crystal structure, in that case, individual crystals are going to tend to, they're going to rotate, and they're going to tend to align in certain directions, okay? This is known as LPO or CPO, lattice preferred orientation, or crystallographic preferred orientation, depending on what term you prefer. And this results, in seismic anisotropy that is felt by seismic waves, okay? Because on average, if you take a bunch of anisotropic crystals of olivine and they all have a preferred orientation or direction, that's going to give you an apparent anisotropy on a sort of large length scale, relevant to the wavelength of a seismic wave, okay? And this is something that we can measure in the lab, or we can measure in sort of natural mantle-derived rocks, peridotite rocks. And what often happens, this is a stereographic projection of a measurement from a lab experiment of how the 100, 010, and 001 axes of olivine align in space relative to the the sort of geometry of the deformation experiment, okay? So here's the shear plane like this. You have right lateral simple shear. The shear direction is right here, okay? And what happens in this particular experiment is that the 1-0-0 axis of olivine, that's the fast axis, tends to align in the direction of shear. The 0-0-1 axis aligns in the shear plane, but perpendicular to the shear direction. And then the 0-1-0 axis aligns orthogonal to the shear plane. So we have a fairly good idea of how this works for pure olivine aggregates in laboratory experiments. So for the upper mantle, we have at least a little bit of a handle on how this works. Unfortunately, it's a little bit more complicated than I made it out to be in the previous slide. It turns out that how the type of fabric, the geometry of fabric that you develop depends on the conditions of deformation. So this here is a plot here on the x-axis. This is water content, and then this is stress, so higher stresses up here on this end of the plot. And this is basically showing different regions of this water and stress space where different types of olivine fabric dominate. And you can see what the geometry of these different types of olivine fabric look like, okay? And some of these differences are pretty big. And in particular, here for B type, which predominates under high stresses and high water contents, instead of having the fast axis align with the strain direction, the shear direction, excuse me, it actually aligns 90 degrees away, which is a big deal for the interpretation of your measurements. But I mean, in general, we have a fairly good handle on how this works. And if you're interested in some review papers on this from a mineral physics experimental perspective, I can recommend these ones. Ved.
So I'm very familiar with this paper. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering, in like the 10 years since it's been published, how is this picture getting simpler or more complicated? How reliable? Yeah. I'm not familiar with the literature.
Yeah, sure. So I guess I would say, since this paper, certainly since the original Jung and Corrado experiments were published, I think that we have come around to the realization that B-type fabric absolutely exists. You can find natural rocks that show a B-type fabric, but it's under very specific conditions. So the cold, high-stress corner of a subduction zone mantle wedge, say. You have water, you have high stresses, you might have B-type fabric. But in, you know, this of course is the one that really makes a huge difference to the interpretation of the measurements. And it's really in very specific conditions that you get it. We also have pretty good databases of natural olivine fabrics from natural rocks. Those also tend to show that C and A type, which are pretty similar in how they express themselves in seismic wave propagation, really predominate. But there are, you know, if you go into the literature, you can find, you know, AG type fabrics that have like a girdle of one of the axes. So it does get complicated. I think given the limitations of the seismic observations, most of the time you can use this sort of a simplified average view of, say, A or C type fabric and you'll be okay. Is that fair? I don't know the order that people have raised their hands in, but Dominique has the mic and then we'll go to Zach and then up here to Esma.
So this ABC type is just mm-hmm. defined on the basis of where they plot in this stress versus water content?
Well, that's the experimental finding. Of course, then you have to extrapolate this to the lab. There are other things this is also temperature dependent. Depending on who you ask, it may also be pressure dependent. That's actually still a little bit debated. But yes, and so you have to sort of take these measurements and then extrapolate them to the Earth. But yes, that is, and the, you know, the underlying reason is that the you know, which set of slip systems in the dislocation creep regime get activated are going to depend on the conditions of deformation.
And that's for the same composition.
This is for the same composition, and in fact, all of these laboratory measurements are on a pure, the polyphase aggregates, but for pure olivine. And so that's yet another complication that's not taken into account in this experimental view. Yeah, we'll go to Zach, then we'll get to Esteban, and then we'll go to Bruce. And I'm already worried about time, but that's okay. We'll get to attenuation.
I'll keep it quick. This was just intended as a follow-up on Ved's question.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that we now think that inheritance of fabric is more important than the sort of ideal,
yeah.
the fabrics that they develop under ideal conditions.
Right, okay, so the question is whether, so these fabrics are all developing from a starting laboratory sample that has random fabric. In the Earth, of course, you have rocks that have perhaps inherited a texture from past deformation processes, and you have to overprint that pre-existing texture with you know, later deformation or later strain. In my opinion, I think the answer to that is yes. I do think that the effects of pre-existing fabric probably matter more than whether you're in, say, the A-type versus C-type regime. But understanding exactly how pre-existing fabrics get reset, how that process works, how much strain you have to accumulate to do that is an area of active research. I'm going to touch a little bit more on some of the complications a bit, including that one. Did that answer the questions that we had over here? I lost track of
No, Maureen, I guess, yeah. You know, you had mentioned that the 100 was the fast axis, and I'm looking at A and I'm looking at C, and they don't look that similar to me. So what am I missing?
Yeah.
I mean, that looks almost perpendicular too.
Yeah, AC and E, yeah, I certainly see what you're saying. I mean, if you take a hexagonal average of these, well, okay, let me see. I have it on a later slide. So the answer is yes, that there are subtleties. And if you look at the shear wave splitting predictions, which I'm going to show on a later slide for A and C, they are definitely different. It depends, you know, for if you have horizontal simple shear and a vertical wave propagation at certain directions, it doesn't make so much of a difference. But your point is taken. They're a little more different than I'm making them out to be. Yes. Yeah.
I think to add to your question, I think the reason A and C oftentimes flip because the unit cell parameters of A and C for olivine are very similar. It's around 4 angstrom and 5 angstrom. B is a very large dimension. That's never a slip direction. So Burgess vector is always controlled either by A or by C. And that can flip either if you have hydrogen, and as Maureen pointed out, in pressure, the A and C compressibilities might be different and they can flip. So the fabric is a very sensitive aspect, but that is controlled by the internal structure volume.
And interestingly, even though the B dimension is much different than A and C, it's the A that's fast. So it's a little, yeah. Okay. Esteban.
Can I give the mic?
Yes.
So I just want to make a comment regarding the B type and water contents on natural peridotites.
Mm-hmm.
Lithospheric mantles, sinolith by definition, they are dry.
Sure.
So if you're going to measure those, they're going to be like the A type.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, a more general way of stating that point is to say that, of course, there is absolutely a sampling bias in what we see at the surface in terms of these rocks. And so, you know, we are certainly not sampling the Earth's upper mantle in an unbiased way when you look at naturally derived prototype rocks. All right, I'm going to keep going, but stop me if you have other questions, of course. We've now talked in quite a bit of detail about the development of olivine LPO, lattice preferred orientation, as a mechanism for producing anisotropy. You can also get it from what's known as shape preferred orientation. So this is a cartoon view of how this might work at the base of the mantle if you have partial melt present. The idea here is that if you have a sort of second phase that has very different elastic constants, such as the contrast between, say, partial melt and a solid matrix, and if those elastic inclusions are aligned, say, in pancakes or tubules or sheets, you will get basically an effective anisotropy from this type of SPO configuration. And this will also, again, on the length scale of a seismic wave, look like seismic anisotropy. So this mechanism may be important in regions where you have partial melt, such as D double prime or beneath, say, a mid-ocean ridge or a subduction zone. There's been some work done lately on whether chemical heterogeneity in the mantle might play a role in producing anisotropy via an SPO-type mechanism, but that is, I think, still under debate how important that is. Okay, so tying all of this together, this is kind of the why do we care slide, all right? So pulling all of this together, the fact that anisotropy, whether it's formed via an LPO mechanism or an SPO mechanism, is basically controlled by strain, it's controlled by deformation, That means that if we can measure seismic anisotropy using observations of seismic waves, we can get at patterns of mantle deformation, patterns of mantle flow. And this is why people like me spend like a lot of their waking hours caring about seismic anisotropy, because it is a clue as to not just the structure of the mantle, but its dynamics and its deformation. Yes?
Yeah. Since now you are talking like using the seismic observation mm-hmm. to get the anisotropy, mm-hmm. so and I wonder how do you get like identify is that if like LPO or SPO,
yeah.
and is there any frequencies like more sensitive LPO and or like
yep.
there's like separate frequency band yep. like which
things do it? It's a great question. So often from the observations themselves, it's tough to tell. We can make some reasonable assumptions about where you might see partial melt. And you know whether observations in regions such as, say, a mid-ocean ridge or a subduction, you know, directly beneath an arc in a subduction zone, conform to predictions from LPO, or whether you require a contribution from melt SPO. But it's tricky. I mean, I think you're already getting a sense that there's a lot of uncertainties here. The frequency-dependent question is a great one because, particularly for the SPO-type models, depending on the size and the sort of geometry of the inclusions, different frequencies can be sensitive to them in different ways. And in theory, you can sort of use frequency dependence as a way of getting at that. In practice, it's often tricky because often for many of these body wave methods, you know, we don't have the you know, say for an SKS wave, you know, you tend not to have a lot of high frequency energy because it's been attenuated, part two. So in theory, yes, and in practice, it's tricky, I would say. Okay, so again, you know, this is just the sort of simplest possible cartoon view of this. But you know, say you have flow in the upper mantle, and this could be driven by absolute plate motion, or maybe it's driven by sort of buoyancy-driven convection in the mantle. But the idea here is that in this case, you have horizontal flow, you have a vertical gradient in the velocity field, so that's giving you horizontal simple shear, and you can that if you have olivine LPO, in which your fast axis is aligning with the shear direction, you can measure a direction of fast wave propagation and tell something about the direction of mantle flow beneath the station. And that's an enormously valuable thing, right? Because if you think of having a snapshot, present-day snapshot of, you know, mantle structure in a velocity tomography model, that's sort of telling you about the structure right now. It's not directly telling you something about the dynamics. And that's why people get so excited about NISO. I get so excited about anisotropy measurements, is because it tells us something about the dynamics, okay? And then, of course, we do have to measure it. So this is a sketch of shear wave splitting. I'm going to talk more about how that works in a minute. But the idea is you can measure this orientation of this fast direction. And we develop these, you know, very much oversimplified rules of thumb. You know, for A-type olivine fabric in this simple cartoon, you might say that the direction of horizontal mantle flow matches the fast splitting direction. But these rules of thumb are oversimplified, and I kind of can't emphasize that enough. They're useful to a point, but they are very simplified. All right, so quickly, I'm going to take us through some methods for observing anisotropy. Shear wave splitting is probably the most popular one. The idea here is that you have a shear wave propagating through an anisotropic medium. Initially, that shear wave has some polarization, so the particle motion is linear, and that polarization is controlled by the source mechanism of the earthquake. It hits the anisotropic medium, and now instead of one shear wave velocity, you have two quasi shear wave velocities. This wave is going to split into fast and slow quasi S waves. They're now going to travel at different wave speeds, so they're going to accumulate a time delay. And a seismologist can measure the fast, the orientation or direction of this fast polarized wave. That's going to tell us something about the geometry of the anisotropy. And we can measure the delay time. And that tells us something about the strength of anisotropy and or the path length that it took through the anisotropic medium. Again, in terms of the phases that we use, another view of this cartoon, here's a collection of some of the seismic shear phases that get used in shear wave splitting studies. By far the most popular one is SKS here. Because this has been converted from a P wave in the outer core to an S wave on the mantle side here, we know its polarization. It has to be SV polarized for the reasons that Sana said in her lecture on Monday. So this is a very popular one, but if you want to look at other parts of the Earth, like D double prime here, or you want to study the upper mantle close to the seismic source, you could use direct S phases, SCS phases. There's a whole sort of zoo. And again, usually we're looking at shear phases that are propagating nearly vertically up beneath the seismic station. And so shear wave splitting is mostly sensitive to azimuthal anisotropy, horizontal variations sort of in the azimuthal plane. Here's an example of a shear wave splitting measurement to give you an idea of what the waveforms actually look like. Up here, I know this is complicated, and in the interest of time, I don't want to talk through absolutely everything. But up here, what we have is these are the horizontal components of an SKS arrival. This is at a station in Oregon. So the dashed one is the radial component. Okay, so that's the radial component. Remember, Sana talked about how we rotate the horizontal components. The radial component sort of points from the station to the source. The transverse component is shown in red. If this was a wave that had not undergone shear wave splitting, you would have no transverse component energy. So just a P to S conversion would all be SV energy, all on the radial component. Instead, we have this really beautiful transverse component. So that is a clue that's telling us that there's shear wave splitting. The way that this manifests itself, these are down here are particle motion diagrams. So imagine, you know, you're like in a helicopter hovering above the seismic station, and you could magically see tiny amounts of motion, which you can't. But if you could, the way the ground actually moves horizontally would look like this ellipse instead of just a linear polarization. And again, that's a clue that you've had shear wave splitting. The way we measure this is we do sort of a grid search over all possible fast directions and delay times. We rotate and time shift the horizontal components, and we find the combination of fast direction and delay time that either minimizes the energy on the transverse component, or you can maximize the correlation between the fast and slow components. You can do a couple different things, and you can get out your phi dt. Okay? Bruce.
The amplitudes of these split waves instead of, or in addition to the travel?
I mean, we use the amplitudes only in the sense that we are looking at the amount of transverse component energy relative to the radial component. So in that sense, it's basically a relative amplitude, but we don't typically look at the absolute amplitudes. Other than just to we want to accommodate the prediction that the fast and slow waves should have similar, identical pulse shapes and identical amplitudes.
With the anisotropy where you actually don't see much in the transverse, just by virtue of the orientation.
Yep, and it's a relative measurement of the transverse relative to the radial, but absolutely. So if your initial polarization of your wave happens to be either aligned either with a fast or slow direction of the medium, you get no transverse energy, and that's what's called a null measurement. If you're 45 degrees away, that is maximized. And you can actually measure that and get this nice sine 2 theta curve and back out the phi dt that way. Yep. The reason that I'm going through this in at least a little bit of detail is that you please remember this. So for those of you who are going to sit in on the seismology tutorial next week, your challenge, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to look for split SKS waves in a data set that Sana is putting together for the tutorial. So keep this in mind. I will also be around because I love looking for splitting. Okay. Just to give you a quick example of some shear wave splitting data sets, this is how they're typically plotted. These are SKS splitting measurements from US Array. Of course, with the US Array data set, we now have this amazing shear wave splitting map of the North American continent. These are just from two different studies, which is why they're two different maps. But the way these are plotted is you'll see a stick on a map. The fast direction is the orientation of the stick is telling you about the fast direction, sort of in degrees from north. So here, the east-west direction is the fast polarization direction. And then often the size of the stick is scaled by the delay time, the strength of anisotropy. So I'll come back to this when we talk a little bit about results. There's really rich patterns here in the the way the fast direction varies geographically. In a continental region, you know, you always have the challenge that you're integrating over the whole upper mantle. I'll have more about that in a second. So understanding what part of this is in the lithosphere, what part is due to present-day mantle flow in the asthenosphere, you know, is a big challenge, and I'm going to come back to this later on in the talk. Another way of getting at this, and this, I'll try to do this quickly, is by looking at actually at receiver functions. Again, we learned in Sana's lecture on Monday that P waves convert to SV waves. And so if you look at a P to S conversion, which is what you're looking at with a receiver function, you're looking at an SV wave that typically shows up on the radial component of your seismogram. So these are receiver functions. Here's your first P arrival. Here's the arrival from this interface here. Okay, and so we would typically see, you know, the MOHO converted phase, say, on a receiver function. When you have anisotropy in one of these layers, so now you have azimuthal variations. These are plotted as a function of azimuth. You have azimuthal variations in the amplitude of your receiver function, and you also now have arrivals on your transverse component. So this is not predicted for the case of a flat interface with no anisotropy, but sometimes you get these conversions on the transverse component. They vary in a very particular way. You get basically like a positive pulse, a negative pulse, a positive pulse, a negative pulse as you go over the azimuthal range. And if you're clever, you can use actual receiver function data. This is receiver function data, again, plotted as a function of back azimuth or direction from the station to the source. This is some work by a student at Yale, Netta Barb, using data from South America. This is from La Paz in Bolivia. And all of the energy over here on these transverse component receiver functions is there because there's anisotropy at depth. And so we can use this to identify sort of specific depth ranges where we have an interface between different anisotropic layers. And again, you get this super nice sort of like, you know, positive to negative to positive to negative pulse at some of these interfaces. So that's just another way that we can get at seismic anisotropy at depth. We can also interrogate this using surface waves. So these now are horizontally propagating waves. This is an example of a Rayleigh wave tomography model for Australia. This is work from Frederick Simons, in which there were a term describing azimuthal anisotropy was included in the inversion. I show the Australia example just because it has such nice azimuthal coverage. Australia is in a really good place to do this because you have earthquakes more or less all around. And if you have good azimuthal coverage, now of course, the time delays, you're basically looking at phase velocity data, you know, how much time does it take the surface wave to propagate. That contains information about both isotropic structure and anisotropy, so you have to have very good coverage to be able to tease those out. But you can put these anisotropic terms in your inversion and get a model for how the azimuthal anisotropy, these, you know, again, sticks on a map, vary both laterally and with depth. We can also look at radial anisotropy using surface waves. And again, this is now the distinction between how fast vertically polarized surface waves versus horizontally polarized surface waves travel. We've known for a very long time that there's a discrepancy there that is due to anisotropy. This is a global model for radial anisotropy in the upper mantle based on surface waves. These are just cross sections through the Pacific Ocean basin and then through the North American continent. So these top ones are the isotropic velocities, and these are pretty coarse models. Certainly this is pre-US array, so we now have a lot more detail here. And then the bottom one is a model for radial anisotropy and how it varies laterally and with depth. So the way the colors work is where you see blue, that means that the SH is faster than the SV, horizontally polarized is faster than vertically polarized, and where you see the warm colors, it's the opposite. You have VSV greater than VSH. And so beneath the Pacific Ocean basin, you have this very strong band beneath about 100 and 200 kilometers depth of strong VSH greater than VSV, radial anisotropy. And there's some, you know, interesting, but I would say still poorly understood structures here beneath the North American continent as well. Finally, you can look at anisotropy using normal modes or free oscillations. I'm going to mostly defer this to Jessica, who's going to talk next week about normal mode seismology. But the idea is that the Earth rings like a bell after large earthquakes. This is an example of a spectrum taken right after the 2004 Sumatra-Andaman earthquake, where you see beautiful peaks for some of these fundamental spheroidal modes here in the frequency spectrum. The fact that you don't see a single peak for a lot of these, and actually they're split into multiple peaks, reflects a bunch of complications in Earth structure. Anisotropy is one of them. And you can take a collection of normal modes, in this example, that are sensitive to inner core structure, sensitive to inner core anisotropy, and back out a model for how these various parameters that describe anisotropy in the inner core vary with depth. So this is from a paper by Caroline Begin, and Jessica has also done a lot of work on this. So I'm quite sure we're going to hear more about this approach next week. Okay. So I hope I've convinced you that observations of seismic anisotropy tell us about dynamic processes in the Earth's mantle. In particular, what are the caveats? So these are the caveats that you need to keep in mind. We've already talked quite a bit about how these variations in olivine fabric type might complicate the story. There are different olivine fabric types. We have only a vague grasp of where, well, it's pretty good, but not a perfect grasp of where in the Earth different fabric types predominate. Some differences are subtle, others are major. And Bruce, this is the slide I was talking about, where if you look at the shear wave splitting predictions for A versus C type olivine, so these are stereo plots for different ray propagation directions through an anisotropic medium. And in some, you know, depending on your propagation direction, it might matter a lot or it might matter a little. And so oftentimes what we can do is take a hexagonal approximation that looks similar to the first order effects here. But it's worth keeping in mind that there are some uncertainties just in terms of the fabric type. There's also some uncertainties just that are inherent in trying to look at complicated mantle flow fields and a complicated view of how texture actually forms. And this gets to the point that Zach was making. Anisotropy in the mantle is a complicated function of the time-integrated strain and fabric development, which takes some time or progressive deformation to develop. This is just a picture from a flow modeling study done by a former student of mine. This was in collaboration with Laurent Montesi, who's here, where we were looking at 3D flow in a subduction zone setting and how the finite strain field sort of varies due to this complex 3D flow. And you could go a step further. This is showing the distribution of the finite strain. You could go a step further and actually model texture development, you know, if you knew which olivine fabric regime you were in, and that's going to take some time to develop along these streamlines. And all of this is to say that when we sort of talk about interpreting anisotropy observations using these rule of thumb relationships, they're useful to a point, but there are a lot of complexities that are not captured, and it's always wise to keep that in mind. Another big challenge in particular for body wave studies is isolating anisotropy along the ray path. I've already alluded to the fact that when you measure the splitting of an SKS wave, it's essentially a path-integrated measurement. So at least in theory, you're integrating anisotropic structure all the way from the core mantle boundary up to the surface. We have very good reasons to assume that most of the SKS splitting signal is in fact in the upper mantle. You know, we can compare azimuthal anisotropy from surface wave measurements, which are not sensitive to the lower mantle, and to first order, they often look similar to SKS splitting. But that is an assumption, and there is some hint of a contribution from deep mantle anisotropy to some SKS and SKKS phases. But all of these body wave phases suffer from this limitation that it's a path-integrated measurement, and if you want to place constraints on the depth dependence of anisotropy, it's difficult if you're just relying on these body waves. Another sort of implication of this is that if you are using these phases to study anisotropy in the deep mantle, yes, Carolina, please do.
Does it help the new developments of, you know, forward wave propagation, full waveform inversion?
Yes, would it help? Does. Okay. It would absolutely help, and I'm going to show another reason why on the next slide. But yes, If you want to use these phases to study anisotropy in the deep mantle, so transition zone and the D double prime layer, you can do it, but they've all of them have by definition passed through the upper mantle in order for you to record them at a seismic station. So you need to be really careful about correcting for anisotropy beneath the receiver if you wanted to study, say, anisotropy near an earthquake in a subduction zone or anisotropy at the base of the mantle. So correcting for the receiver side and selecting stations that will allow you to correct for the receiver side signal is really important. When it comes to full waveform effects, so this is what Carolina was getting at with her question, full waveform effects are important, and we have several studies that show us that. You know, all of what I'm going to show is basically interpreting anisotropy using ray theory, but departures from that can be quite important. It's an okay first order approximation, but we need to think about the full waveform effects. In particular, there's several recent studies, and actually really going back to the early 2000s, we've sort of known this, that for some phases, it's not a problem so much for SKS phases, but for some shear phases, isotropic structure can lead to sort of contamination of the waveform, you know, in a way that can be mistaken for shear wave splitting if you are not careful. Okay, and so this is an example. This is from a paper that came out last year by Parsi and others. They were specifically looking at SCS phases at the base of the mantle and looking at how you might trick yourself into thinking that they're splitting just based on isotropic structures. So one of the ways to get around this is to move towards a full waveform framework, and we're going to hear more about that later this week or next week when we hear from Abreu. To interpret these observations, and on the observational side, if you are careful about how you analyze your waveforms, oftentimes you can tell. A sort of savvy and careful shear wave splitting analyst can tell the difference between transverse component energy due to splitting and transverse component energy due to contamination. But this is something to keep in mind. Yet another limitation, I've talked a lot about upper mantle anisotropy, and as I said, we have a fairly good handle on how LPO development in olivine works. That gets less true the deeper you go in the mantle. For the mid-mantle in particular, we have lots of evidence that there is anisotropy in the mantle transition zone. I'll come back to this. But we don't know very well, you know, what minerals contribute. I mean, we kind of know what minerals are down there. We don't know very well what are the relationships between strain and anisotropy, because it's hard to do deformation experiments at the pressure and temperature conditions of the mid-mantle. And the problem sort of gets almost even worse at the base of the mantle. We don't know whether the major controlling mechanism is LPO of lowermost mantle minerals, such as post-perovskite and ferroperoclase, or perhaps bridgmanite, whether it's shape preferred orientation of partial melt or a combination. We don't know which phases contribute. Our knowledge of the single crystal elastic constants at those very high pressures are imperfect. We don't know the dominant slip systems, and so we don't always know the texture that's going to develop. So uncertainties in the mechanisms for anisotropy in the deep part of the mantle, and this is true for the inner core as well, is really imperfect. All right, so now that we've covered the limitations, I want to spend maybe 10 minutes or so just talking about some observations. What can we actually do with observations of anisotropy, and what are some of the things that we've learned in recent studies about how this works in different parts of the Earth's mantle? Okay, so let's start with ocean basins. So this is a global model of shear wave behavior, both isotropic velocity and also azimuthal anisotropy, and what's plotted here is the azimuthal anisotropy part of the model. This is by Eric Dubai and Yannick Ricard. Again, the sticks on the map are indicating the fast orientation or the orientation of the fast wave propagation direction. This goes from depths 50 kilometers down to 200 kilometers, so this is upper mantle. Lots of complexity in the continental parts, but I want you to focus on the oceanic parts here. And one observation that's been, you know, around for a while, but has really kind of crystallized and come into focus over the last few years, is that for these global models beneath ocean basins, we see anisotropy that more or less looks consistent with the idea that in the oceanic lithosphere, you have azimuthal anisotropy that's basically frozen in from plate spreading processes. Okay, so you're sort of, you have the plate spreading, you're basically freezing in anisotropy that reflects that local plate motion. As the lithosphere cools and grows, you're freezing in that anisotropic structure. And then as you go a little deeper, we see sort of more consistent fast directions here, at least beneath the oceanic Pacific plate. And this is thought to reflect the idea that in the sort of asthenospheric upper mantle, you're seeing, particularly beneath fast moving plates, you're seeing absolute plate motion, parallel shearing between the plate moving above it and then the mantle beneath it, some combination of that as well as density driven flow from mantle convection in the deep mantle. And so, you know, even a few years ago, I might have told you that, sure, we don't understand everything, but we're starting to get anisotropy beneath ocean basins worked out pretty well. There have been some surprises, though, and in particular, this is a result that came out of the NOMELT experiment. This is work by Patty Lin and collaborators. They took data from this experiment here in the Pacific Ocean, which, as I understand it, was sort of designed to target like the most boring piece of oceanic lithosphere that they could find, away from plumes and seamounts and hotspots and all the complications. And this is great. I mean, this is what happens when you go and study like the boring parts. It turns out they're not boring, right? And in particular, they found, so they made some measurements of azimuthal anisotropy by looking at ambient noise-derived phase velocities as a function of period here. And again, this is just showing the phase velocity measurement as a function of direction. You get these really nice like sine 2 theta curves. The velocity varies with back azimuth, that's anisotropy. And they put this together into a model, and what they thought they might see was strongest anisotropy in the shallowest part of the asthenosphere from shearing between the oceanic plate and the mantle beneath it. Instead, they saw really strong anisotropy in the lithosphere. That was a little bit of a surprise that was stronger. It is generally, sort of parallel to the fast spreading direction, but maybe not quite. And then in the asthenosphere, they did see anisotropy. It doesn't align with plate motion, so this is maybe more consistent with the idea that you have either density-driven flow from deep mantle, overall mantle convection, or perhaps small-scale convection in the mantle. And the strongest parts of the anisotropy, at least of the asthenosphere, is not right at the base of the plate, but a little bit deeper. So even beneath the places that we think are understood fairly well from an anisotropy perspective, ocean basins, there are still some surprises and some things to work out. Now let's look a little bit at global models for radial anisotropy. So again, this is the difference between SV and SH, vertically and horizontally polarized surface waves. So this is a series of global models. This is from a paper by Chung and others in 2015. This is their model. And here I'm just plotting the radial anisotropy part of it, okay? Where you see blue colors, that is VSH greater than VSV. Red colors are VSV greater than VSH. And this is for a series of depth slices going from 100 down to 400 kilometers. A few things to notice. First of all, I think everyone involved in all of these studies would agree, there is considerably less consensus on the radial anisotropy structure, that part of mantle structure, than there is on isotropic wave speed velocities. There is sort of to first order at long wavelengths, some consensus among the different models. Here in the shallow parts, there's pretty good, relatively strong VSH greater than VSV anisotropy just about everywhere, particularly strong here beneath the Pacific Ocean basins. That shows up in a lot of these models. But, you sort of lose that coherency, and there's a lot of structure in these models, maybe suggesting that there's a lot of intriguing variations in radial anisotropy down into the transition zone, but not a lot of agreement in the fine features. Ved. You do have to wait for the mic.
I guess I just want to make a comment.
Yes, please. So you're in this business, so.
Yeah, nearly all of the authors represented in these papers, except maybe for Chang, would argue, although actually, no. All of the authors here would argue that
there's very little evidence for radial anisotropy that's substantial below about 300 kilometers.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I want to, you know, in defense of global radial anisotropy tomography, note that the color bar changes with depth.
It does.
And that
so
at
this
400
is showing
kilometers,
yep.
it's very, very small.
Yep,
you're talking
absolutely.
About 3% variations. The patterns are kind of patchy. They're low amplitude. I wouldn't really worry about that. The vast, vast majority of the radial anisotropic signal comes from the oceanic asthenosphere,
yep.
which is what you pointed out. And
totally
there,
agree.
You know, it's fairly
yeah,
good.
It's
stronger
so
in the oceans than in the continents. It's very strong in the central
yep.
Pacific.
Yep, strong VSH greater than VSV, sort of at asthenospheric depths, yep.
And then
yep.
the differences really boil down to a couple of choices. To get the radial anisotropy, one has to invert both Love and Rayleigh waves,
mm-hmm.
which have different depth sensitivities. And so that inversion, kind of how you cook it, how you combine the data, those choices end up being very important. And the other thing that's very important is how you treat the crust. Great.
Yes.
So, but don't worry, guys, about like 250 and below.
Yes.
That's like weak.
Yes, although, I mean, and Ben, you sort of alluded to this a bit, you know, I mean, some authors sort of are pushing, you know, interpretations of that deeper structure, but that's, yeah, that's absolutely true. And certainly, again, also in defense of radial anisotropic tomographers, yourself included, I mean, these have really come a long way in large part because a lot of progress has been made on overcoming exactly those limitations that you just articulated, and in particular, getting a good handle on correcting for crustal structure and not letting the effects of crustal structure leak into the radially anisotropic part of your model. I mean, these have really have come quite a long way. Yes.
So one comment on crustal corrections
mm-hmm.
is that I think we should try to avoid crustal corrections.
Ah, okay.
I mean, I'm not sure if there is any better way of doing crustal corrections. Of course, depending on the period range, you can argue on it, but I think it's time to consider
okay,
avoiding
crustal
corrections.
Okay, I hope you're going to tell us more about that.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, all right. Okay. I'm looking forward to it. A vigorous discussion of this. Okay, all right, so moving on. Just again, a few examples of the kinds of things that you can do with anisotropy models or anisotropy observations. You can use them, and I would say we, or really the geodynamics community, is getting better and better at doing this, at using them to test as a sort of test of different models for global mantle convection. And there are a bunch of people that do this. This is a paper that Torsten Becker published last year, and he's going to be at CIDR later on in the meeting, where he took a global model of azimuthal anisotropy derived from surface waves from Schaefer and Lebedev. And he took that model and then ran a series of global mantle convection models with a few different you know, ways of implementing surface velocities. Either you impose them or you let the model drive them. And in particular, with a bunch of different rheology, or a bunch of different viscosity models, including some that have a very low viscosity in the asthenosphere, and then used azimuthal anisotropy basically as a discriminant to say, well, which of these global convection models does the best job at matching the overall azimuthal anisotropy signature. And of course, the matches are not perfect, and you have these are, I think, average deviations, you know, between the model predictions and the observations, and they're quite substantial. But we are certainly pushing to the point where we can use anisotropy observations basically, you know, as a way of testing, as one way of testing predictions of global mantle convection models. Subduction systems, I could talk for 5 hours about subduction systems if you let me. I won't, though. But these are, you know, of course, a particularly complicated tectonic setting where we really don't have a great handle on what the flow field looks like, and in particular, how the flow field might deviate from that simple, like, 2D cartoon that we all have in our heads of how a subduction zone works. And this is a question that can be tackled both from the geodynamical modeling side. This is a study from Facenda and Capitanio, where they did a very nice sort of 3D numerical model model of flow in a subduction system that had significant trench rollback, trench migration, and that you get this very nice kind of 3D toroidal flow field. And they said, well, where in the system might you see different geometries of anisotropy? And then we can test the predictions of these models against observations. And I think there's a lot to be said about this. This is a compilation of SKS splitting measurements in the South America subduction zone. Some of these are parallel to the trench, which is sort of not what you'd expect from the simplest 2D corner flow model. A lot of these are perpendicular to the trench, which is what you would expect from a simple model. There's a lot of a long strike variability that's not really well understood. And, you know, again, without giving you my whole worldview on subduction zone anisotropy, which would take a long time, I'll just say that our ideas about subduction zone flow patterns are evolving beyond a simple 2D paradigm, which is great and exciting, but there are still many unsolved problems, and I think it's still a rich area in which we can learn a lot about subduction processes. Within continents, anisotropy, because in the sort of old, cold, stiff, not really currently deforming part of the continental lithosphere, part of the continents that is the lithosphere, there we see anisotropic structure that is likely reflecting past deformation processes, such as mountain building or rifting, or perhaps continental formation. Looking at the anisotropic structure of the continental lithosphere, I think, is a hugely important and exciting area of inquiry. This is an example of a model. This is Yuan and Romanowitz from a few years ago. Here we're looking at basically a cross-section. This is a model of azimuthal anisotropy. I accidentally took the color bar off here. The color bars basically are showing the fast direction of anisotropy some sort of degrees from north. Here where you see red, that's almost parallel to absolute plate motion. Blue is a distinctly different orientation. So you can see that we see layering within the continental lithosphere. That's cool, and we would like to understand the source of this layering. We have gotten some complementary constraints on this from these receiver functions that I briefly introduced. This is a study that Aaron Worth and I did a few years ago, where we took a look at the mid-lithospheric discontinuity beneath some seismic stations here in the central part of the US, and saw that the MLD, this mid-lithospheric sudden drop in velocity internal to the continental lithosphere, actually coincides with a contrast in anisotropy. And again, you see that in the azimuthal variation of these receiver functions. So a lot of new observations. I showed the SKS splitting maps for US Array, another really rich source of observations, and figuring out precisely what this tells us about continental deformation and how it relates to past tectonic processes, I think, is super exciting. Going a little deeper into the mantle, I think understanding observations of anisotropy in the transition zone is a very cool frontier area. I've mostly talked about the upper mantle, but we also have some anisotropy in the deeper parts of the mantle. This is from a surface wave model. This is an azimuthal anisotropy view at a depth of 600 kilometers from Yuan and Began, so where they see evidence for sort of at the edge of the resolution of what you can do with a surface wave model in terms of depth, but they see evidence for azimuthal anisotropy in the transition zone. There's some evidence for radial anisotropy, as Ved said, that is debatable, and it's in any case much smaller than what we see in the upper mantle. We also see evidence from the source side shear wave splitting of deep earthquakes. This is some work that a former student of mine, Colton Linner, did, where we see evidence for about a second of splitting that we attribute to anisotropy near the earthquake source in subduction zones for very deep earthquakes at transition zone depths. And so I think that this might tell us about how subducting slabs behave in the mid-mantle as they interact with the transition zone discontinuities, and maybe the viscosity jump at 660 or maybe a little deeper at 1,000. I think that there's likely information in here about how that works. Then finally, just a little bit about the base of the mantle. So we do have abundant observations of anisotropy in the D double prime region. Again, this is in contrast to much of the lower mantle, which looks isotropic. This is a map. This is a paper that Neil Acrisi, who's here, has currently in review. This is just sort of summarizing body wave observations of D double prime anisotropy. We also have constraints on radial anisotropy from global models. And a lot of regions of D double prime have been investigated and do show strong anisotropy. A particularly exciting thing that several groups are trying to do is find regions where we can target the anisotropy over multiple azimuths and try to get tighter constraints on what that geometry might be. As I mentioned, we don't have a very good handle on what the mechanism is for anisotropy at the base of the mantle. This is a series of models that Heather Ford ran, where she took this set of observations of shear wave splitting beneath the Afar Peninsula, just outside the African LLSVP, and tested those observations against a bunch of different models for lowermost mantle elasticity. These are three orientations of post-perovskite that seem to fit the data. There are a lot of caveats involved in this kind of study, but we are starting, I think, to get to the point that with some reasonable assumptions about what mechanisms might be, where we can start to take observations of anisotropy at the base of the mantle and relate them to flow patterns. And for this particular study, we noticed that all of the post-perovskite models that fit the observations had a 1-0-0 axis of post-perovskite that was oriented nearly vertical or highly oblique to horizontal. And so we use that to make an argument about a likely component of vertical mantle flow at the edge of the LLSVP. Again, lots of assumptions and lots of caveats here, but we're getting to the point where the kinds of studies that I showed a few slides ago, you know, Torsten Becker taking global convection models and comparing them to predictions of azimuthal anisotropy in the upper mantle, we're getting to the point where we can do that for the lower mantle as well. I think I saw a hand. Did I? Yeah, I did. Yes, I did.
The lower mantle.
Yes.
There's a big space there.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I glossed, like most anisotropy people, I glossed over the lower mantle. Yes, I can. Well, there is a reason, and the reason is that we don't have a lot of observational evidence that there is anisotropy there. So both in sort of global models of radial anisotropy and to some extent azimuthal anisotropy, although you sort of lose your ability to image that in the lower mantle, in the global models, and also from body waves, we don't see evidence for strong anisotropy. And it is thought that the reason for that is that the lower mantle is deforming via diffusion creep or a deformation mechanism that does not form LPO, does not form anisotropy. So what that implies, you know, by comparison then between the lower mantle and the D double prime layer, is that you have either a transition at the base of the mantle back into the dislocation creep regime where you can develop LPO. And that, you know, that might make sense if you have, say, slabs coming in and you have higher stresses at the base of the mantle. Or you might have an SPO type mechanism which doesn't require dislocation creep. So that observation is actually probably telling us something pretty important about how the mantle deforms at different depth ranges. Did I see another hand? Is that a hand, Laurent? No. Okay. All right.
Marie, I just wanted to make a comment, not comment really, on the dynamics, but there are some interesting questions at the end of taking the flow models and turning them into anisotropy, right? And so the most common assumption is to take the axis of maximum strain, right? But that and then you do some stuff with the texture, which you guess, and you know, you use these codes and so on for that. But I think on the mineral physics end, and perhaps Lars or others can comment on this, there's a question is, what is it that aligns the crystals? This is the stress, for example, or the strain rate. And that, I mean, these are things that we can know from the simulations, from the mantle flow models. And in fact, depending on what you do, right, you can get a better match to some of the anisotropy. So yep. I did this once, didn't publish it. But for example, if you do the sort of net tractions under the Pacific, you get a much better match to the anisotropy rather than using just, you know, the prescribed flow, for example, and deciding whether you're going to use the strain rate tensor or the stress tensor. Yeah. I never went that far to actually trying different things. But I think there are interesting research questions. It's too bad that Torsten isn't here.
Yes.
And yep. to explore at that end of things.
Yeah, so. I totally agree. And I think, you know, I've highlighted a few of those questions, but there are, you know, I mean, this is the business I'm in, right? But I mean, there are a lot of, I think, very fundamental aspects of Earth structure and processes that we at least have the potential to get at with anisotropy. And I know I've focused a lot on the sort of caveats and the uncertainties, and those are all there. I'm about to segue into attenuation for the last 20 minutes. I want to leave on sort of an optimistic note and not a pessimistic note. And Carolina, that was a great sort of segue, because I think you're absolutely right that there's a lot of things we want to know about the Earth's interior that can be informed by anisotropy observations. Interesting things that we care about. Right. I mean, I am a huge nerd about seismic anisotropy, so like I care about anisotropic wave propagation. But for most of you, the reason to care about this stuff is that it tells us something about Earth processes, and in particular, dynamic processes. So even if you're not an anisotropy nerd like I am, you need to care about this stuff. All right, Laurent, now you have a comment.
But when you returning to the lower mantle things, I mean, mm-hmm. I think you actually made the point, right? Maybe you have some SPO type of mm-hmm. process. You don't observe anything, so maybe there isn't an SPO type of process. But isn't that kind of what we would expect in if we follow the models of the beams that Maxim and Christine mm-hmm. have proposed recently? Because they have this strength contrast that mm-hmm. makes a lot of shearing. Do we not expect actually development of some kind of layered and SPO type of process along the edge of these objects?
Yeah, okay. So Laurent is alluding to the beams model, and I don't, that maybe hasn't been brought up yet at this meeting, but I know a lot of you have probably seen it. So is Christine in the room? Christine has worked on this, and Maxim Bulmer. So this is the idea that you might have large regions of the lower mantle that are very strong because they're enriched in bridgmanite. And they're sort of resistant to deformation, and then the idea is that you might have, just as Laurent said, sort of strong shearing at their edges, you know, maybe as that is accommodating downwelling and upwelling. Yeah, so the question is, that might imply that we might see strong anisotropy there. I guess I would say that there's not, I don't know of strong observational evidence for that, but it may be worth revisiting in light of the beams model. You know, again, it may be that the lower mantle is just deforming via diffusion creep, which does not produce LPO. But I do think it might be worth revisiting that. That could be a CIDR project for somebody. Revisiting that in light of some of these new models for how mantle convection might work and the configuration of mantle flow. All right, attenuation in 17 minutes. Let's do it. Okay, so I'm going to start this by making the somewhat obvious observation that seismic waves attenuate, that is, they lose amplitude as they propagate. Okay, and you can get this just from very simply thinking about, this is an intensity map, a shaking intensity map for the Northridge earthquake in Southern California in the mid-90s, and you can see that the strongest shaking is here, close to the earthquake epicenter, and then as you go travel farther and farther away, the shaking gets less intense, which means that the amplitude of the waves propagating are getting smaller. There are many reasons for this, more on that in a minute, but one of them is anelasticity. This is the departure from the perfectly elastic N-member that we have assumed in our derivation of the wave equation. Okay, just a point of clarification. Attenuation basically means the amplitudes get smaller, and strictly speaking, that encompasses a big range of processes. Often when seismologists say attenuation, they mean anelasticity. They mean what we call intrinsic attenuation. So just watch out for that. When a seismologist says the word attenuation, they usually mean anelasticity or intrinsic attenuation. Okay, so what affects the amplitudes of seismic waves? So we've had several talks that have alluded to this from various perspectives. When you have reflection and transmission at a sharp boundary, the amplitudes of the reflected and transmitted waves are going to change, and they're going to be controlled by the impedance contrast at that boundary. We have geometrical spreading, and that's really the first order process that you see in this figure. The energy in the seismic wave field gets spread out over the surface area of a sphere for body waves, or over the radius of a circle for surface waves, and so you have just a geometrical effect, you know, if you're standing further away from the streetlight, it looks dimmer, right? That's geometrical spreading. We have scattering, and in Nick's talk last night, we heard a very, you know, nice way of representing that scattering as well as measuring it in seismic observations. We have multipathing, also known as focusing and defocusing, which Sana alluded to. And in the case where you have multipath waves that have constructive or destructive interference, if they're arriving at the same time, that's going to change the amplitudes. And then finally, we have anelasticity. Okay, so the first four of these are elastic processes. These are all accommodated in that perfectly elastic assumption that we made in deriving the wave equation. This last one is not. It involves the conversion of seismic wave energy to heat. So this is the dissipation of energy of the elastic wave field into heat. Okay, so again, all of these processes are important. Four of them are described by elastic wave theory, and the fifth is not. So much of seismology is built on the approximation of perfect elasticity that it's easy to forget that this is not the case. But if you think about it even for a minute, you realize that if the Earth was not anelastic, then seismic waves from every earthquake that ever occurred would still be reverberating, right? And that is obviously not the case. So that tells us that we have to have some dissipation of seismic wave energy into heat. There are many important implications and applications of anelasticity, and that's the subject of the last 17 minutes of the talk. Okay, so you can see just from a very sort of simple picture of the seismic wave field that anelasticity has to be important. This is a record section of surface waves from the Sumatra-Andaman earthquake in 2004. So this is a global record section. The y-axis here is distance from the earthquake in degrees. So 180, you're on the other side of the Earth. Okay, and then each of these wiggles is a seismogram. So here are the surface waves. And what you can see is that as these surface waves propagate around the Earth, their amplitudes get smaller. So around 90 degrees away, this is just geometrical spreading. They get smaller, and then you actually get then sort of almost a focusing effect from geometrical spreading, where all of that energy is going to come together at 180, right? So if you were just thinking about geometric spreading, you would expect a minimum at the distance of around 90, which we sort of see, and maxima at 0 and 180, okay? So then what we see, if you follow this around, is we see surface waves that are continuing to propagate all the way around the Earth and sort of like coming back to the source. And then they keep going, and they continue to propagate, and they continue to propagate. But the amplitudes of these later guys are dropping off. Okay, and again, in a perfectly elastic world, that wouldn't happen. We would just have the geometric spreading. But the fact that these amplitudes are dying off with time is the effect of anelasticity. Okay? So a couple of equations, I'm going to gloss through this super fast. One way to model this is to use an analogy with a harmonic oscillator that has a spring and a dashpot. You've all seen this, where you think about just the oscillation of a mass on a spring that's controlled by Newton's second law. And you can have this equation, this is really just F equals ma, where the force is provided by the elastic response of a spring. K is the spring constant, okay? And the solution to this equation is a perpetual harmonic oscillator, which can be described here with this cosine function. And the mass is going to oscillate back and forth with a frequency that depends on the spring constant and the mass. And once the motion is started, the oscillation is going to continue forever. Okay, so that's the elastic case. When we add damping in this sort of spring and dashpot model, you add an extra term in this equation that has this damping factor. The damping force is proportional to the velocity of the mass. So we have this du dt, u is position or displacement here. And you can sort of rewrite this damping factor in terms of a quality factor, which depends on the frequency of the oscillation as well as this damping factor. Okay, and the solution to this more complicated equation looks like this. So now you have a harmonic oscillation, but its amplitude is sort of dying off like so. And you can back out this quality factor Q by looking at the ratio of the amplitudes for successive peaks in this now damped harmonic oscillation. Okay, so this is a very sort of simple way of describing how this works. A little bit of terminology. So you'll hear seismologists talk about both Q and attenuation, or inverse Q. So Q, again, is the quality factor. It has more convenient values. So Q in the Earth is, you know, maybe 100 to 500 or so. You know, Asana said the other day, we like talking about numbers greater than one. So oftentimes, you know, we'll talk about Q because the values are more convenient. But inverse Q, you know, the attenuation is sort of directly rather than inversely proportional to the damping. The thing you need to remember is where you have no attenuation, Q is infinite and 1 over Q is 0. Where you have high attenuation, Q is low and 1 over Q is high. It's very easy to slip and say Q when you mean attenuation. I'm positive I'm going to do it sometime in the next 10 minutes, so when I do it, just call me on it. Okay, so where does this anelastic behavior come from? All right, now, you already know that the Earth deforms elastically on short timescales and as a viscous fluid on long timescales, okay? And the reason you know this is because you saw Sana's lecture on Monday and then you saw Bruce's lecture yesterday, right? And both of them derived the momentum equation very nicely, and then they said, okay, we need a constitutive law, right? And Sana said, okay, my constitutive law is Hooke's law of linear elasticity. And Bruce said, okay, my constitutive law is this one that's appropriate for a viscous fluid, right? And then Sana got the wave equation and Bruce got eventually the Navier-Stokes equation, right? So you already know about the difference between this and this, okay? And it turns out that in addition to just having the elastic and viscous end members, we have a transition between fully elastic behavior and fully viscous behavior, okay? And that transition depends on frequency. So this, the x-axis here is the log of frequency. So high frequencies over here, low frequencies over here. And what you have, this top plot, is the behavior of the shear modulus, okay, which controls shear wave speeds. And you have this transition from elastic softening. You get this gradual frequency-dependent softening of the shear modulus. And it sort of transitions into viscous behavior, which is relevant for, you know, this is tectonism, but things like mantle convection. And there's also an associated dissipation of seismic energy in a way that's going to depend on the frequency. Okay? So when we talk about anelasticity, what we're really talking about is the relaxation of the shear modulus and associated dissipation of seismic energy. This is governed by some very complicated microphysics. There are processes that go on within a grain of, say, olivine for the upper mantle. You have basically the distribution of redistribution of defects, such as dislocations or vacancies. You can have intergranular processes, such as grain boundary sliding. You can have melt processes, like melt squirt, where melt is sort of moving around into different cavities in between the grains. Or you can have melt enhancement of grain boundary sliding. There's a whole bunch of very complicated mineral sort of microphysics here. I'm mostly not going to talk about the details of that, but Ian Jackson has an excellent article in the Treatise on Geophysics, if you're interested in the gory details. All right, so why do we care about this? There are several reasons. So intrinsic attenuation, anelasticity, is affected by quantities that we care about, and we'd like to know how the Earth works, right? So it is affected by things like temperature, grain size, presence of and behavior of partial melt, maybe water, maybe oxygen fugacity. There's a bunch of important variables that we would like to know that affects seismic attenuation, and that's something that we can measure, okay? So observations of attenuation are complementary to other observables, such as seismic velocity or electrical conductivity. This is just a cartoon view of this, but this is just showing that seismic velocity has this sort of, you know, linear relationship to temperature, whereas attenuation, inverse Q, has more of an exponential relationship. This relationship is not linear. The idea here is that if you have a seismic velocity model and you want to know whether those lateral variations in velocity, say, are telling you about lateral temperature variations or lateral variations in composition, you don't know that just from the velocity model, but if you have observations of attenuation as well, you can basically tell the difference because of this different and complementary dependence on temperature. Another important point that is often, I think, glossed over because we're so used to living in a perfectly elastic world is that if you want to actually scale seismic velocities to temperature, you know, say you know that they are controlled by temperature, You actually have to take into account this softening of the shear modulus because of the anelastic effect. And this actually departs fairly significantly from a purely elastic calculation. So if you want to calculate temperatures from velocities, you need to think about this. All right, so I've already listed some of the factors that may affect attenuation. It's really quite complicated. This is a cartoon view of this. This is from a paper that just came out a couple of months ago by Klein and others. This is from Ian Jackson's group. And in their view, in much of the upper mantle, its attenuation is basically thermally controlled. So there's a temperature control on the anelasticity as well as on the velocities. Beneath a mid-ocean ridge, both Q and VS are probably influenced by melt. And again, this is a little complicated because it depends on exactly what effect of the melt you're looking at, and melt enhancement of grain boundary sliding may be more important. In a subduction zone, they list melt as a major factor, as well as oxygen fugacity, and this, I think, is a fairly new observation. In this paper, they actually say that water seems to not make a huge difference, but these are new results, and I have the sense that this is potentially controversial. But anyway, there's a very, you know, one of the reasons attenuation measurements are tricky is because there's a lot of factors, and these are not independent either, right? I mean, if you raise the temperature, you might also change the grain size, and you might also cause things to melt. So a lot of these factors are linked and are not, these are not completely dependent. All right, a super quick tour of how we measure attenuation. This is basically the same observational seismology toolkit as we use with anisotropy and many other things. You can look at normal modes, and again, it's fairly straightforward to sort of measure how the amplitude of these peaks on a spectrum that shows you normal mode splitting or normal mode peaks, how they decay with time. So, and because different modes are sensitive to different depth ranges, you can build up a global model of Q. And again, I'm sure Jessica's going to touch on this next week. You can look at surface waves. So all of the information that we get about isotropic velocities or anisotropy from surface waves just come from measurements of the phase of the travel time. But of course, you can also look at amplitudes. Just to give you a sense for what the data look like, this is, of course, with the US Array data, you get a beautiful view of this. This is from Colleen Dalton's group, Bao et al., where they took surface wave measurements from a bunch of earthquakes all over. And for individual events, this is what you can do with a dense array. For individual events, you have, in this example, an earthquake coming in here. You can measure the travel time. I mean, these are basically sort of more or less orthogonal to the wavefront here. And then you can also measure how the amplitudes vary. And you can see there's actually quite a bit of variation for this particular arrival in those amplitudes. We can also see this in body waves, and this is a really lovely observation. This is from Zach's work with Jeff Abers. They took data from the Cascadia Array OBS experiment. This is just one particular, I think this is an S-wave arrival, is that right? Yeah, so this is one particular teleseismic S-wave arrival. It's just sort of plotted across the array. They're color-coded by age of the seafloor, so we go from the ridge all the way to the trench here. And you can just see by looking at the data that the amplitudes vary quite a bit, right? So you have much lower amplitudes here near the ridge axis and the higher amplitudes here, and then they get low again in here. So we can make these measurements from body waves. This is often measured in terms of this attenuation parameter, which contains information about both intrinsic attenuation, but also things like focusing and defocusing. So it's a little tricky to interpret, but you can come up here with basically a map of these average attenuation parameters. And this is telling you something about anelasticity. All right, so what can we do with these observations? I'll illustrate this with an example. This is from Colleen Dalton and Uli Fau. And what they did was they took two similar global models, one of attenuation over here, this is Colleen Dalton's model, and one the isotropic part of the velocity variations here. Similar data sets, hopefully similar damping and things like that. And what they did was queried these models and looked at an individual depth ranges and then points on the map, what the velocity and attenuation values are, plotted them up and got this field of points, and you can kind of contour these. The green is showing like 75% of the points from old continental regions, and then you have young oceans in red and old oceans in blue. And then you can compare that to a model based on lab data for thermally controlled anelasticity. So this is from Fall and Jackson, right? And there's a bunch of different lines here. These are the experimental predictions for different grain sizes and activation volumes. And you can basically say, okay, all the points here that lie along this line are consistent with thermally controlled variations in both attenuation and velocity. And all the ones that lie outside of it are telling us about something else. Okay, and they made some really nice maps of, like, you know, here's a population of points in the model that lie outside this experimental trend, and here's where they are, and these lie outside the experimental trend in a different direction, and here's where they are. And they can sort of say, okay, well, you know, a lot of these red points are beneath this mid-ocean ridge, and that likely is pointing to the effect of melt on anelasticity and velocity, which is not in this particular model. And then similarly, a lot of the blue points are within or adjacent to continental regions, so that might be telling us that here the velocities are controlled by compositional variations, say. So these are the kinds of things that you can do if you have attenuation measurements. There are some caveats and challenges here. Attenuation is really tricky. You know, I mean, I do anisotropy, which is tricky enough, but attenuation is truly a tricky thing to get at. A couple of the challenges, just to illustrate this, you know, you can measure amplitudes on a seismogram, and that is at least sort of a straightforward measurement. But as I said at the beginning of this section, amplitudes are affected by many things, including scattering, source effects, the size and radiation pattern of the earthquake, local site amplification, and then focusing and defocusing as rays get bent or deflected by isotropic wave speed structure, right? And you really do need to account for this if you want to get at Q, if you want to get at the anelasticity part. And this is a very nice set of figures from Colleen Dalton and Jeroen Ekström's work. These are from Colleen's global attenuation model. So here's a view centered around the East Pacific rise here and then North America. In these top panels, they took their amplitude data and just inverted for Q for attenuation without taking into account all of this other stuff. And this is the model in these two places. And then in these bottom panels, they took into account focusing and defocusing and source and receiver terms. And this is the model they get for intrinsic attenuation. And they're really different. So you have to be very careful about interpreting your amplitudes in terms of anelasticity. Another set of challenges comes from the experimental side. These are super hard experiments to do. The reason for that is that you need to do them at seismic frequencies. You know, think back to that plot I showing the gradual transition from purely elastic to viscous behavior that depends on frequency, and you need to do them in the right frequency band. This is a photo of the torsion apparatus in Ian Jackson's lab at ANU. And you know, they can do it. They have to do it over a big range of frequencies that are relevant for seismic waves. You have to do it over a bunch of different temperatures. You know, then you have to extrapolate in pressure and grain size from the lab to the Earth. And if you want to do that extrapolation, you have to know the details of the mechanism and exactly what's controlling this on a sort of microphysical level. So all of this is just to say that the experiments themselves are super challenging. I have to wrap up, don't I? All right, I'm going to leave you, I guess, with, what am I going to leave you? You get 10 seconds of one-dimensional models for Q in the mantle, okay? So low attenuation in the lithosphere, high in the upper mantle low velocity zone, and then an increase in Q with depth, higher Q in the lower mantle. Here's, you've already seen a bit, so I can skip through this. This is another view of Colleen's model for how this varies laterally. We can also measure this in subduction zones. This is an example from the Central American subduction zone where you see really nice evidence for where partial melt is being produced in an arc. And then we can also look at this beneath continents. You know, we know this varies between continental interiors and the continent and the tectonically active Western US just based on how far away you feel earthquakes. I love to show this plot. But again, with the US array data, we're just getting really beautiful models for the details of how Q varies. within the North American continent. And some of this, some of the first order stuff is maybe expected, you know, high attenuation, low Q in the western US, high Q in the continental interior, but there are some intriguing features like some high attenuation here beneath the eastern US. And I think figuring out what all this means is gonna be a cool challenge. Okay, I'm gonna leave you with a parting thought. A lot of cutting-edge seismology research gets done by assuming an isotropic and perfectly elastic Earth. Okay, that is a true statement. But if you are willing to take on the considerable challenges associated with considering anisotropy and attenuation, you can learn a lot. Okay, and I'll just leave you. I know I haven't said anything about these figures. I showed them on my first slide too. I just wanted an example of co-located anisotropy and attenuation measurements, and this is from my own experiment in the Appalachians. If you want to know about this, ask me at coffee. But I think that, you know, the payoff from taking into account anisotropy and attenuation is potentially huge. This tells us information that we can't get from other observables, so these are challenging problems, but the potential scientific payoffs are big. And I will leave you with that thought, and we should go to coffee. I don't know if there are any other questions, or if we're all just dying for caffeine.